Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a presidential call to action in America, the federal deficit spikes, and in the Arab world, uprising. In his State of the Union address, President Obama reached back to look forward, to challenge.
This is our generation's Sputnik moment.
The next day, the Congressional Budget Office pegged this year's federal deficit at $1.5 trillion. Here's the CBO director.
The longer the necessary adjustments are delayed, the greater will be the negative consequences of the mounting debt.
And scenes of uprising in the Arab world. Here today, Cairo, Egypt.
They were confronting also thousands of riot police. Some of the demonstrators were actually tearing paving stones from the streets, breaking them in half, and throwing the bits of stones along with bottles at the police. They were firing back with rubber bullets, water cannons, and tear gas.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Diane Brady, senior editor for Bloomberg Businessweek, Michael Crowley, senior correspondent for Time Magazine, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to win the future, as the president asks? Ready to whip the deficit? And what do you see unfolding right now in the Arab world, in Egypt's day of rage? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. It's hard to take our eyes and ears off that Egypt story. We will come to it, but I want to dive in, if we can, first on this big deficit number out from the, as everybody says, nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. Diane Brady, $1.5 trillion. The president was talking this week in his State of the Union speech about making big investments. He must have seen this number coming. Does it all add up, Diane?
Well, it certainly dampens the optimism somewhat, I think, when you start talking about the deficit. So the reality is he did not get into the entitlement programs, and a lot of what he was calling for basically is contingent on big government, these investments in high-speed rail, renewable energy. The reality is government has to get bigger for these jobs to happen, and his first priority is getting Americans back to work, and then he'll deal with the very big problem of the deficit.
There's a big debate here. Let's hear some of the back and forth. Here's Republican Alabama's Jeff Sessions saying that Mr. Obama, well, that he's just not up to date with the deficit.
To hear the president remarks, one would think his speech had been written 10 years ago. Now, they were disconnected from the reality of the debt crisis that we face.
But the day after the State of the Union address, the president was out in the country on the stump in Wisconsin saying we can't be back on our heels here. We've got to lean forward, as he put it, to win. Here he is speaking at a power technology company in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, saying American business must be bold.
If we're on defense, if we're planning not to lose, somebody else is going to lap us. Is there a lot of hungry folks out there, a lot of countries that are gunning for us? So we got to play to win. We've got to play to win the future.
To win the future, it was his phrase, along with Sputnik, his phrase of the week. Michael Crowley, how do you see this playing out? Two views of what needs to happen right now, you know, throw on the spending brakes or cut and invest, as the president would say. How do those two meet in the political arena, Michael?
I don't think anyone knows yet, Tom. I mean, to some degree, we are watching a giant game of chicken in Washington right now being played on the two ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. Republicans, for their part, have to decide what sort of cuts they think they can sell politically, because although the public is concerned about the deficit, when you start to get specific and say, how do you feel about cuts to this program or that program, farm subsidies, maybe they should go. Well, a lot of voters in the Midwest, plain states, are very fond of farm subsidies and suddenly worry about the deficit somewhat less. At the same time, I think the two parties actually do have some agreement about cutting back long-term entitlement programs. I think what the president is trying to do is delay that conversation a little bit because he wants to make sure that we don't talk too much about cutting in general at a moment when he feels that the economy still needs more stimulus and that a retraction would actually be bad for the economy. But that's the second game of chicken, is who is going to be the first to start talking about serious cuts to programs like Medicaid, Medicare, to some degree Social Security, although it's not as significant a problem. So there's no way to predict right now how it's going to play out.
Big meeting of economists at MIT this week, real top tier, many of them saying, you know, the sugar bowl of stimulus that has kept this thing up, got it up and kept it up a bit here, is running out of juice. We've got this 3.25 now GDP growth they're talking about in the news. That's a good sign. But, Jack, I want to ask you about the music of these two themes this week. The president in his State of the Union in that dappled chamber with the Republicans and Democrats next to one another, and right after it, Wisconsin's Paul Ryan, Republican, now chair of the House Budget Committee, with a darker view.
Our nation is approaching a tipping point. We're at a moment where if government's growth is left unchecked and unchallenged, America's best century will be considered our past century. This is a future in which we will transform our social safety net into a hammock, which lulls able-bodied people into lives of complacency and dependency.
Complacency and dependency, but I don't feel many people feeling complacent these days, Jack. And I mean, so much of that is gone, it doesn't exactly feel like dependency. But what I'm more interested in is what moves Americans here, that Sputnik moment challenge that we've got to stand up and fight now, you know, cut but make investments where we need them, or slam on the brakes, baby, because we can't keep this up.
Well, historically, deficit cutting, you know, budget cuts have not played. It's what closed on Saturday night in America. I think that's just the case. Now, there have been moments when that wasn't true. I think the Perot campaign in 1992 was one of those moments. But basically, that's not a selling proposition.
But that's what Jeff Sessions was saying, Jack. That's history. Historically, yes, but we're in an ahistorical moment.
Well, I know. I know. But leave out the policy issue here and just get to the, you know, just to look at the politics. The politics are punishing for somebody who really wants to make inroads on the deficit, as I think Paul Ryan does. And once they start coming forward, as Michael said, with the specifics, the Democrats are going to pounce. They've done it already this week. They've figured out how many FBI agents would go, how many food inspectors would go, how many, you know, bureaucrats would lose positions here, and things that people like in the national parks there. Well, that's going to go on for months. And you know, I've been reading the National Journal reports that the Ryan idea of voucherizing Medicare, which is kind of a third rail idea, is actually something they make that Ryan may come forward with his budget. Now that's really dangerous.
You know, the politics of cuts are punishing, but the Republicans won a majority in the House with exactly those politics. Last November, Michelle Bachmann was back on the same Tuesday night after the State of the Union with her own rebuttal to the president. Here's the Minnesota congresswoman.
Many of you implored Washington to please stop spending money that we don't have. But instead of cutting, we saw an unprecedented explosion of government spending and debt. It was unlike anything we'd ever seen before in the history of the country. Well, deficits were unacceptably high under President Bush, but they exploded under President Obama's direction.
Big and bigger. Of course, there was a bigger crisis than ever. Diane Brady, give us a business view of this. I mean, economists saying, okay, we've got growth, we've got a slow recovery, but, you know, there's not a lot in the tank of what pulled us out of this. The Dow up around 12,000. Tipping point into darkness or beginning of something new? Or how does business look at all this, Diane?
Well, I certainly think let's not forget what got us here in the first place, that September 2008 moment where we had to pour a lot of money into the economy. But in general, when you look at where we are right now, there's record cash on the books of a lot of companies. Clearly, the Dow is doing well. So a lot of signals for the economy are very positive. The reality is, though, a lot of the growth for companies is coming from overseas. They are not hiring. They are concerned about corporate taxes. They always are, frankly. And so the economy is looking a little fragile, especially if you're somebody who's out of work, as 15 million people are, and that underestimates it. So we are on the right path, but the feeling is that we're not out of the woods yet, especially because of the housing situation. And there's a lot of eyes on Washington and what's going to happen with policy. That will affect jobs.
Not much left in the kitty in Washington. Here was that economist, Northwestern economist Bob Gordon at MIT yesterday, saying the U.S. continues, despite that growth rate, to have major problems, noted that interest rates way down by zero, can't go lower. Here was his metaphor to describe the country's economic situation.
thinking of World War One. We've run out of ammunition for the machine guns and the howitzers. We're in the trenches, and all we've got left to fight with are swords and throwing stones. The Fed is pretty much out of the picture.
There we go, Michael Crowley. He's saying, you know, don't look to the federal government to give another shot in the arm to this economy. But the Dow's up at 12,000. Somebody's optimistic.
Right. Well, again, they may be optimistic for reasons that are not encouraging to Americans looking for work. In other words, they're optimistic about their growth prospects in other countries. But that is one of the most troubling things about the economic situation, which is that we probably will be hard-pressed to withstand another substantial shock. We've pretty much used all the tools that are available. You know, the Fed has already kind of maxed out its powers, more or less, and, you know, the political system has basically reached stalemate. I mean, it was a great frustration on the part of the Obama economic team sort of last fall. They felt like the economy could use another shot of stimulus, and they came to realize that it just wasn't going to get through the Congress. And obviously now, with Republicans having taken the House, you're not going to get stimulative spending in any sort of imaginable scenario. That said, you know, economic growth is steadily picking up. It's not enough to bring down unemployment swiftly, but as a political proposition, you know, I think the CBO this week forecast that around the time of the 2012 election, unemployment will be somewhere around 8%. That's about the range where the kind of conventional wisdom of political operatives say what Obama needs to be able to get reelected. So
Michael,
the economy may save him the nick of time.
We've got to take a break right here. We hear the din of Egypt calling, and we will go straight to it. We're looking at a big week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Arabs in the streets, you hear them right there in Cairo today. Call to win the future from the President of the United States, and the U.S. deficit hits $1.5 trillion this year. Michael Crowley of Time Magazine is with us. Diane Brady of Bloomberg Businessweek. Jack Beatty. Mohamed Baradei, Nobel Peace Prize winner, came back to Egypt yesterday. Went to prayers, got blasted with water cannon in the streets. We read now under house arrest. And the latest headlines, this is from Al Jazeera, which has been, you know, really pushing what's going on here, but it's got a push of its own. It's saying Egyptians chanting for army help after police action in the streets. They're running battles in the streets of Cairo. Here's the Nobel Peace Laureate and pro-democracy advocate Mohamed El Baradei, been an outspoken critic of Egypt's regime, that is Hosni Mubarak, spoke with reporters after flying into Cairo yesterday.
I have to give them as much support, political support, spiritual, moral support, whatever I can do. I will be with them. They are my people, and I have to be there, and I'd like to see a new Egypt.
He'd like to see a new Egypt. He's under house arrest. Sam in Lexington, Massachusetts, thanks for calling. You're on the air, Sam.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's really breathtaking to see that occasionally democracy really happens in the world, and to see that it started in Tunisia like a wildfire, and I'm sure it was always smoldering underneath the surface, but just when you lose faith that democracy can happen, it happens. And you can only pray that it'll happen in the rest of the world, and who knows, maybe even in our own country.
Michael
Crowley, very exciting to watch.
Yeah, Sam, I appreciate your call. Michael Crowley, you've written a lot about this region. What do you see unfolding here, and what does it portend for, first of all, the Egyptian people? Can you imagine a scenario where Hosni Mubarak, he's 82 years old, he's ruled for, what, 3 decades? His government has received billions and billions and billions from Washington. Can you see him on a plane to exile in Saudi Arabia? And what about the American position here, Michael?
Well, I can't predict with any authority what's going to happen. And these popular movements are always, you know, they have a way of surprising you. They can fizzle out quickly, or they can snowball very quickly. I would say that, you know, one big difference between Egypt and Tunisia, where you did see the leader forced out a few days ago, is that there is a much stronger and really more brutal security service and army that kind of runs the show in Egypt that I think is going to provide much more of a bulwark. So at the moment, I guess I'm skeptical that Mubarak will be chased away, overturned. On the other hand, this is a country where it's illegal for a small number of people to gather in public without the permission of the state. So the mere fact that these large crowds are marching through the streets, there's violence, they're tearing down posters, is really saying something. But the thing that is so fascinating here is that this is a classic case, to your caller's point, of sort of being careful what you wish for. I mean, I think that Americans, many Americans would find themselves, and I'm sure in the Obama administration, find themselves torn between sort of rooting for a popular uprising against an autocrat with a record of repression and torture on the one hand, and on the other hand saying, well, then what comes next? What comes after him? Could you imagine, for instance, a government that did not want to continue Egypt's peaceful ties with Israel, that was not helpful from the U.S. perspective in the Middle East peace process? What if a new Egyptian government...
Peace process? What process?
Well, it's a fair question, but...
more than fair. There isn't one. It's been sort of, snuffed out.
That's right. Although it could be worse. I mean, another hostile Arab state in that neighborhood would not be to Israel's benefit. And specifically, the last point I would make is that right now Egypt has been cooperating with the U.S. and Israel in squeezing Gaza in a way that many people feel is inhumane. But in an effort to bring down Hamas. Well, what if an Egyptian mm-hmm. government opened the border with Gaza and worked with Hamas, and suddenly Gaza was starting to flourish? It would completely scramble the equation. So, and without
that equation is not very pretty. That equation is not very pretty. It looks like it may need, I don't know, at least some scrambling. I mean, not to Israel's benefit, but there's 80 million Egyptians here. I want to keep them in mind as well. Here's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton at a press conference on Wednesday. It has not been easy for Washington to keep up with this. When you look at what's happening in the streets there, she said that the Mubarak regime should use the revolt as a chance to listen to the will of its people.
We believe strongly that the Egyptian government has an important opportunity at this moment in time to implement political, economic, and social reforms to respond to the legitimate needs and interests of the Egyptian people.
Jack Beatty, she's singing the reform song as, the tens of thousands are in the streets, maybe taking over.
Yeah, and they're saying revolution. They want a new government. Michael draws attention to the security forces. Those are a U.S.-built bulwark against the people. $60 billion, I read today, over 30 years. Now, that has purchased us something, and I think Michael gave the argument what it purchased, a little something for Israel, a cold peace there, certainly.
Well,
but
a lot, though. I mean, it's been many years of some kind of stability. Israel's built an economy, and...
absolutely true. We got something for it. The question is, on the other side, what did it do? It built this massive apparatus. It gave the government no need to reform. And now that army, that money that we poured in there, can be used and probably is now being used to crush this revolt. And, if this were just an isolated case, well, maybe we had a, realpolitik is necessary. We went through this with Iran in the 70s. I think we're going through it with Pakistan today. U.S. foreign policy has a capacity to just keep making the same error. And when in Cold War times, you had a kind of ideological justification for it. But increasingly today, the idea of, propping up these corrupt regimes for very short-term political gain, or in the case of Pakistan, to keep the nuclear
pretty big
out
deals,
of the hands
pretty
of the,
big deals, Jack.
Pretty big deals. But again, if all you're doing is building up the wave that finally pushes the regime out and leaves you with an alienated new regime, what have you gained?
Well, our listeners are all over this, watching how Twitter and Facebook have been involved. Here's Rob on Facebook saying Egypt shutting down the internet should be a wake-up call to the rest of the world. His conclusion is we need to keep print newspapers and old-fashioned airwave radio alive. The internet, easy to pull the plug on. Let's go to Jerry in Cookeville, Tennessee. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
What I kind of find amazing is I heard this morning how they're using... like community organizing tactics, going from door to door and handing out flyers. And I remember last year listening to WKU Public Radio out of Bowling Green get the BBC
sure.
news there.
Mm-hmm.
And they mentioned that Bill Ayers and his wife were there, and they were training people with community activists and community organizing tactics.
So what do you say? I don't know anything about the truth or not of that, but would you be in favor of people training community activists in Egypt or not, Jerry?
Yes, well, that's exactly what they said on the BBC. They were teaching them peaceful, civil disobedience techniques.
It sounds like they've got a lot of insight of their own on how to do that these days. I appreciate your call, Jerry. One more, Michael in South Burlington, Vermont. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm very much pro-democracy, and I think there's a lot of really good stuff that's going on by these demonstrations. The one thing I'm really concerned about is I watched TV the other night about the riots, and what, I'm not sure if this is accurate or not, but what was said was that the Islamic Brotherhood was very involved in this whole demonstration.
Well, it's huge in the country. It's the number one opposition movement there, I guess.
Yeah, but the Islamic, you know, I mean, I think we have to look at the fact that, let's say, the revolution works,
yep.
okay?
Yeah.
And there's a takeover. And what if the Islamic Brotherhood are the ones, like Hamas, who take over Egypt? Is this really going to make the country less repressive? Is it going to make the country more democratic?
There's the conundrum, though, maybe, Michael. I mean, what if that's what the people vote for with their feet, or as they voted, literally voted for Hamas?
But nobody knows that, Tom.
What do you mean nobody knows that? We know they voted for Hamas.
Yes, I mean, we know that. But I'm saying in Egypt right now, the big cry is freedom, democracy, you know.
Well, sure.
The repression. But what I'm saying is, you may get a government like what happened in Iran, as an example.
No, we definitely get it, Michael. I mean, there's the dilemma, but I don't know if Egyptians see it exactly as a dilemma, though they might. I mean, Diane, it's interesting here. Mohamed El-Bardai comes back. He's seen as someone who could head up a secular alternative to Mubarak. And here we are within a day. Mubarak has got him under house arrest. This looks like the old politics of Mubarak saying to the United States, what do you want, me or, you know, Islamic extremists in power, Diane?
Well, exactly. And I think ultimately people are less interested. Yes, they want freedom, but what they really want are jobs. And I think that a secular regime would be fine if they could actually create an infrastructure where you've got young people at work. And this sounds very basic, but when you look throughout the Middle East, when you look at Pakistan, we've all known one of the big issues, and certainly a huge issue in Egypt, is that 30-year period has really wreaked havoc on the young generation. Their unemployment is rampant, education is not kept up. And what they really want is an income, and they want to see a future. We felt it here in the U.S. in terms of what we feel is the threat of terrorism from that region. But the reality is that those governments have huge domestic problems because that's what people are really worried about, is they have no economic future, and there's been a massive gap between the poor and the rich.
$2
and
a day income. Yeah,
exactly.
A huge gap, $2 a day income. But at this point, I think a pretty firm view on the part of many there that Mubarak has responsibility for that. I'm looking
very
here.
Very much so.
Here's the latest news out of Egypt. Egyptian state TV announcing a 6 p.m. to 7 a.m. curfew in Cairo and a couple of other cities there. The clampdown is on. We'll see if it works. Let's go to Sliman in Boston. Sliman, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I am an American of Algerian descent.
Yes.
And I'm from north of Africa, Algeria.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And I just want to make a comment. What is happening in front of us right now, it's so overwhelming. I'm having a hard time speaking my mind. I mean, it's just the fall of these dictators. I mean, these criminals. It's about time, I say. And I feel, yesterday I felt Tunisian, and today I feel I'm an Egyptian. And hopefully this will be a domino effect that will crumble all these criminals. That's all what I had to say.
So let them go. Let them be gone, you say. And here's a Facebook comment from Saeed or web comment saying, many in the U.S. government are trying to give the Bush or Obama credit for the uprising in the Middle East. Well, clearly in part. But he says the truth is this is a grassroots movement. Sliman, thanks. One more right here from Peabody, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Tom. Real quick, my concern is, or just wonder what your thoughts are, if the region did go democratic, sort of like us, capitalistic, what would they do with their oil? And you know, what if the U.S. had all the oil and everybody else wanted it?
Of course, we won't have all the oil, but I don't know. Diane, what about that? If, you know, here's Sliman talking about a domino effect. He's not the only one. Big riots or a protest in Yemen, and we've seen them in Jordan. You're hearing even peeps out of Saudi Arabia. I mean, in business terms, if we see these autocratic regimes starting to go down or to have big changes, how are people anticipating that? Is that in the price of oil rise we've seen recently? Could it go?
I think there's always concern when there's political instability, and that does affect the price of oil. I don't think we're as dependent, certainly, you know, of Egypt in that. In fact, you know, you can ramp up the oil sands, which is a huge source of oil from Canada. They're not going to riot anytime soon. But I think the real issue here is less about the access to oil than it is about what we've been talking about, which is the fact that it is an ally, that we want that part of the world to be peaceful. Certainly oil is a factor. The price of oil is a factor. But I don't think it's the overriding concern here.
Of course, we want it to be peaceful. We want it to be democratic. Those two may not, at least in some transition, be compatible. Here's Hillary Clinton again on Wednesday talking about the American government standing behind those wanting change in the region.
People across the Middle East, like people everywhere, are seeking a chance to contribute and have a role in the decisions that affect their lives. And as the President said in his State of the Union yesterday night, the United States supports the democratic aspirations of all people.
Yes, but it gets scary too. Ahmed in Montreal, Canada. Ahmed, you're on the air.
Basically, I just want to say the youth have been frustrated. Egypt's been years now. The majority of Egyptians are youth. And now the opportunity came to come out. They're not going to back off. That's it. Mubarak, he's finished, and that's it. And the other point I wanted to make is about the Islamic boogeyman that everybody keeps on talking about.
Yeah.
Everybody's worried there's going to be an Islamic boogeyman over there. Egypt is majority Muslim, and I don't think that people should worry. Islam is religion of peace, and inshallah, that's what's going to happen.
Ahmed, I appreciate your call. Yes, all the way through. Jack, I mean, never mind. Don't raise up this Islamic boogeyman.
Yes, and President Mubarak, for years, he's been saying, après moi, le mullahs. I mean, that's
yes,
been his,
yes.
You know, but you know, Michael from Vermont, he talked about, you know, he saw that the Muslim Brotherhood was mentioned. Well, I've read reports that say that they're kind of marginalized, that this rising or this insurgency has sort of caught them by surprise as well, and that this is much more unorganized people, middle-class people working. You know, there was apparently a big strike where people were killed, and that has nurtured this as well, and that it's much more a secular, we've had enough protest than it is one that's, at least at this point, religiously directed or stimulated.
At this point, I mean, we hear reports as these battles go on in the streets of ordinary people throwing water and lemons down to protesters, their eyes full of tear gas, I guess trying to help them. Michael Crowley, this did not come out of the Islamic Brotherhood. But if they stand up, as they have today with their call for people to come out in the middle of it, could it sideline that many diverse sort of secular voices who appear to have thrust this this pushback into the streets?
Right. Well, I think that it's true. The movement sort of doesn't have a face right now, and there's a little bit of jockeying to become that face. Al-Baradei returned to Egypt a couple days ago, you know, I think trying to capitalize on this. But it's not clear that he's really the unifying figure. It's not clear that the Brotherhood are. And so it's not clear who would be swept to the top if there was a change in government. But, you know, the last thought I would just say is there are some other this is happening in Yemen at the same time, a country where
yes,
we're very concerned about terrorism. And, you know, should it trickle into Saudi Arabia? The strategic consequences of that are kind of mind-boggling. So we really don't know where this is going.
Mm. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Snowmageddon again in the east. It's really piling up.
I think it's too much. I just want to stop.
Yes, I'm already sick of it because it just doesn't seem to want to stop.
Enough, man.
The 25th anniversary today of the Challenger space shuttle explosion that killed seven astronauts. Here's Mission Control from that day and President Reagan.
Obviously a major malfunction.
We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them this morning as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God.
To touch the face of God, and we all remember that image of everything breaking up high in the heavens. And singer Gladys Horton has died. She made hits.
This is about man. Oh, yeah. Please, please, Mr. Bowman. Oh, yeah.
We're looking at a week in the news. Arabs in the streets, a call to win the future from the president and the U.S. deficit hitting $1.5 trillion this year. Diane Brady, senior editor for Bloomberg Businessweek, is with us. Michael Crowley, senior correspondent for Time Magazine, and our own Jack Beatty. I want to get to the Financial Commission, the big Financial Commission's report this week and more, but we're just not done with the Arab world. Justine, New Milford, Connecticut. Justine, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Hi, Tom. Well, in listening to the conversation, I think that what is missed, I'm someone who spent a lot of time in Israel-Palestine and in that region, done work and so forth. The Palestinian resistance to occupation, you know, especially the Intifada of 1987 and then again in 2000, the people in Egypt and Tunisia and certainly many other parts of the developing world really identify with that ongoing struggle. And so, you know, it's like that's the constant opposition to undemocratic policies, certainly in the case of Palestinians.
Justine, I don't doubt that's really a significant factor. But when you see these tens of thousands in the streets in Cairo, in Alexandria, in Suez, do you really think it's the Palestinian cause that is primary in having them out there? What about the $2 a day income and all the frustrations?
It's not about Palestinians. So what I'm saying is that our government continues to look the other way when that resistance is going on constantly, and other people in the Arab world identify with it. They keep the pot stirring, and so it's not surprising. Plus, the thing that happened in Gaza a year ago, the invasion by Israel into Gaza, was highly identified with the suffering of people there, and that goes on.
Yeah, it was pretty rough, Michael Crowley. I mean, what about it? Is this part of the price of not having a peace process? I mean, you know, you hear voices, we've heard them in these tapes from Saber Erekat, the chief of Palestinian negotiator, saying, where's Barack Obama? He promised all this intervention, promised we'd have something going on here, and we've got nothing. Is this the price in part of that grinding to a halt?
Well, it's quite possible. I mean, for instance, I do think that Mubarak is not where, you know, as they say, the street is in his country on Israel and the Palestinians. There's quite a lot of anti-Israeli and even anti-Semitic sentiment in Egypt, but officially the government has friendly ties there. But, you know, I know from personal experience, a visit that I paid there around the time of Obama's speech, that, you know, Israeli diplomats in Cairo feel like they are in serious danger. And I met with one who had a bodyguard sitting, you know, a couple tables away in the cafe. Now, that might be kind of par for the course for the Middle East, but the point is that you have a situation where there's a cleavage between the regime and the average Egyptian, and I think it probably does feed the sense that Mubarak is out of touch with the street, with the people, is kind of a puppet of the West, and you know, talks a good game but doesn't really deliver. Instead, just accepts a lot of American aid, and you can understand how ordinary Egyptians who identify with the Palestinian cause would be enraged by that.
Think this through for a minute with us. If he should be gone, if we wake up tomorrow morning and he's sitting in Saudi Arabia, along with his family, what happens in Israel? I mean, the whole Gaza situation, as I understand it, couldn't go on without Egyptian cooperation, all those tunnels and stuff coming in, and Egypt's important to the status quo, as unpleasant as it may be for everybody there right now, not to mention their whole sort of backstopping the status quo more broadly in Israel and with the Palestinians. If he were gone, If Egyptian sort of royal hand in there was gone, at least as we've seen it, Michael, what might that mean?
Well, that's right. Again, it's unpredictable. But as I was suggesting before, you're right that the status quo is not a good status quo by and large in the peace process or what's left of it. But a key part of Israel's strategy right now and America's strategy is to a big problem is the Hamas takeover of Gaza. And the U.S. and Israel want to squeeze Gaza and squeeze Hamas and sort of teach a lesson, I suppose. A lot of people find that sort of an immoral strategy, but essentially to say, if you want to put Hamas in power, then you are going to be blockaded and you're going to have a miserable standard of life. Whereas in the West Bank, under the Palestinian Authority, the economy is growing and people are doing okay in relative
terms. But all that now, sounds like yesterday's perspective. If you've got a much less friendly government suddenly sitting in Cairo, abutting Gaza and saying, look, it's not going to play the way you guys think it's been playing.
Yes, just my closing thought is that that strategy has required Egypt's cooperation. Mm-hmm. Egypt has closed the border with Gaza on the southern side. And if that was no longer the case and that border were to open and goods and supplies could flow in and people could move back and forth, it kind of blows up that U.S.-Israeli strategy of trying to blockade Gaza. There's no more blockade. And that's a big problem, and that's going to force Israel to go back to the drawing board.
Andrew in Columbia, South Carolina. Andrew, you're on the air.
Yes, my question was, we went into Iraq to try and give them a democratic government. We're still there trying to support their government and give them a clear path to democracy. You know, that's what Tunisia, that's what they want. And apparently Cairo and Egypt is trying to go in the same direction. And I was wondering if there's been any signs of support from the U.S. government trying to help Tunisia set up a democratic government, and if you think that there will be the same thing, we'll give them the same thing in Egypt.
Yeah, Andrew, we're losing you a bit there, but Jack, I mean, here's you know, rhetoric and real politic get all bundled up together here. The U.S. went into Iraq with that pro-democracy flag flying high, but there were many interests there, not least of which Iraq sitting on top of so much oil. And you know, here's Andrew wondering, well, are we going to, you know, send the cavalry in to back up the demonstrators in Tunis and Egypt? It's been a much more, what, iffy support than that. Here's, you know, there's all these WikiLeaks cables that came out, and among them, and this is just fresh from AP in London, saying the U.S. ambassador in Cairo warned Washington to be less confrontational in its dealings with the Egyptian regime, toning down the human rights pleasure to avoid jeopardizing relations with the Middle East ally. And this from dozens of U.S. diplomatic cables released by WikiLeaks Friday, Jack. I mean, that's the opposite in this case.
Yes, and I think our policy is changing on the fly. I mean, on Tuesday, Secretary of State Clinton said Egypt is stable, basically. On Wednesday, she was saying, well, they've got to reform in order to be stable. What she's going to be saying tomorrow, we don't know. I think she had it right a week or so ago when she, I think in Doha or someplace like that, she gave a statement saying, basically, the Arab world faces a crisis of rising expectations. These young people, half the population of Egypt under 30, have no hope, have no political hope, have no voice. And this can't go on. That the barrier to Arab development in terms of the economy and so on is rooted in this political system that just doesn't allow for any kind of feedback from the people. That's top down, and we support the top. We pay for the repression. And that's on everybody's mind out there. Yes, you posit circumstances where the Gaza could open up. But, you know, whose fault is that? I mean, isn't that partly that we have built up this regime and that, you know, it couldn't sell? It didn't even try to sell this policy to its own people? I don't know. But U.S. policy is trying desperately to catch up with a situation that's a freedom movement that's getting out of its hands.
It's hard to peel our eyes away. One more call on this. We've got more to talk about, and we won't ignore it in the days to come. But Saeed in Westfield, Massachusetts. Saeed, you're on the air.
Hi there. I think that this is a great move for the people of Egypt, and it should go all the way till Pakistan, in between Pakistan and Egypt. Every single Arab country, they do not have a freedom, they do not have a democracy, they never saw the life, real life. You know, they live in a brutal regime, And this has nothing to do with Israel or Palestine. This is freedom and human basic human rights. And also, this is better for America if we support democracy and we do not support any more Arab dictators. This will be better for peace. This will be better for Americans, and this is better for our economy. We don't have to give them any more bribes to, you know, keep the control. They are using extremists as a chip, and they are using it for their power.
Saeed, you've got a very clear analytical view of it, and I really appreciate your call. I mean, freedom, democracy, and basic human rights. This is going to undress American foreign policy and make us really look at it and think about it, I think. I've got to turn back to the American economy because that's where we live. That's where we sit. We had this Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission this week coming out with its final report. A lot of it along political lines, sadly. But here's Chairman Phil Angelides saying the government officials and Wall Street executives could have, should have, done more to prevent it. It was preventable, the meltdown, he says.
This crisis was avoidable. Despite the expressed view of many in the circles of financial and political power that the crisis could not have been foreseen, there were many, many warning signs that were ignored or discounted.
Ignored or discounted, and we all lived with the meltdown and the bailout and all the rest. I am Brady. There was so much tension around this commission for such a long time, and it finally comes out, and it's got the main report and then Republicans with a couple of different reports of their own. But the big conclusion could have been avoided. Does that mean we've taken steps to avoid it happening again, Diane?
Well, there's certainly some regulation out there that wasn't in place. I mean, it feels like I even feel I'm to blame now. It was such a broad-based report that I think there's some credence to the argument that it was perhaps too sweeping and it was more a narrative than a real analysis.
Maybe you are to blame, Diane. You and every other journalist.
I probably am. I'm refinancing as we speak. So, but I do think that the situation is clearly different. I mean, had we known about derivatives and the perils, maybe we would have regulated them and included them 10 years ago. But
people certainly talked about the perils of derivatives before the meltdown.
They did. I think that one of the disappointments people had was that there perhaps wasn't more of a focus, a sharper focus on, say, the credit rating agencies, the Fed, the bankers. They were certainly in there, but it was as part of a very broad report, and I think that it'll be poured over for years to come. It certainly reinforces what many of us already know, but you know, how we act on this going forward is a little hard.
It may have been broad, but the conversation in Davos, Switzerland, where a lot of big money, big power people have gathered this week, got very pointed this week at the World Economic Forum annual meeting. Here on a panel of business executives yesterday, you'll hear first from Jamie Dimon, that's J.P. Morgan's CEO, who was pushing back against all the criticisms of bank executives.
Not all bankers are the same. And I just think this constant refrain, bankers, 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 it's really an unproductive and unfair way of treating people. And I just think people should stop doing that. I think it denigrates everything. Not all companies are the same, not all CEOs are the same, not all media is the same. And so we try to do the best we can every day.
Do the best we can every day. But we all remember a couple of pretty bad days there now. And in the commission's report, a couple of a few years where things weren't going so swimmingly. But later that same day in Davos, the French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, he struck back at Dimon, saying that banks, the major banks, defied common sense. And you hear what he's calling for here. He'll speak French. You'll get the translation.
Those who in 2007 got bonuses, and even in 2008, when things started collapsing, should have been sanctioned.
Jack Beatty, look at this commission report. Now out, you know, all this time after the collapse. What is this it? Is this our country's big wrap-up of everything that just happened to us? As Diane says, it reads kind of like a 550-page potboiler. But where's that pointed, that edge in it, Jack, that says bang, bang, bang? Here, I don't know, the French president says sanctions.
Sanctions. And where is are there going to be criminal referrals out of this? Now, I saw some statements. The Huffington Post had some earlier this week that that was somewhere in this report. The chairman mentioned that they were referring some things. I don't know exactly what. I think about deceptive mortgage lending, that sort of thing.
Are we as tough on ourselves now as we were in the aftermath of the great crash in the 30s, Jack, 29 into the 30s?
Not at all. I mean, the Pecora Commission then gave a sweep, even under the Hoover presidency, gave a sweeping and scalding critique of Wall Street. More importantly, there were, even in the hearings of the Pecora Commission, rituals of degradation. J.P. Morgan was subjected to a midget sitting on his lap and was made a figure of fun. Now, there was a moment there where Banker Diamond and others were before the Senate committee and they had their moment, but there's been nothing like that, and these people are going on as if nothing had happened, paying their bonuses, and no one has paid for the vast, you know, swell of human misery, their greed, their excesses, in league with the politicians and the regulators created. And I think that just that moment, that sense that no one has paid for this, is just umbrageous.
That looks back, Diane Brady. Look forward. Might we be back in this kind of situation again? Do you see greater oversight, greater responsibility on the bank's part now than we saw 2 years ago?
I don't think so, and I think we now have a fundamental problem of dealing with the unemployed and dealing with these people who've been out of work for more than 6 months. I mean, I don't want to make it too macro, but the reality is Japan was downgraded this week. We've seen riots in Europe. We have to address the fundamental problems of the economy. I don't think anything in this report is helpful in that respect.
Diane Brady, senior editor with Bloomberg Businessweek. We appreciate you being with us this week so much, Diane. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And Michael Crowley, senior correspondent for Time Magazine. Michael, thanks for being with us again. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Jack Beattie, same to you, sir. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. They're sure using that in Cairo these days, at least until it was shut down. Follow us at On Point Radio to become a Facebook fan of the show. And we hope you will. To get daily updates and a sense of On Point backstage, hit the like button on our Facebook page, On Point Radio. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.